Well, I wanted to talk about the personality of Jesus from John 7 here. And when we talk about the personality of Jesus, another way is to be talking about the Spirit of Jesus. Because we are to have his Spirit. We are to receive his Spirit. And it is all about a relationship between us and Jesus. That's what the whole essence of Christianity is about. So the question, therefore, is, well, who was he? How was he with people? And in practice, the answer to that is, well, keep on reading the Gospels. Because here in the Gospels, you have him as a person. This is biography, if you like, of a person, time and again, four separate takes on it. And this, I suggest, is almost the essence of being a Christian, to read and reread these gospel records and to know him. I know you can know him by experience of him in your life, as well as reading the text. But I think that reading the text is significant, surely, as part of knowing him. So, we start off in our search of Jesus as a personality here. Verse 1, Jesus would not walk in Judea because the Jews were trying to kill him. And it's a feast of tabernacles. And he says in verse 6, my time, and that's the word for feast, my feast isn't yet prepared. In other words, he was calculating his own death at Passover. And he's saying, well, this is tabernacles. Now, I will arrange things so I don't die there. In other words, when he did die at the next Passover, this was because he had calculated that. And as he says elsewhere, no man takes my life from me, I give it of myself. So there's something about him, a man who, as an act of the will, gave his life. In other words, he didn't just let circumstance happen to him, and it's not true in that sense to say that the Jews or the Romans murdered him, although in a sense they did, but the essence of it was that he gave his life. That was the essence of it. And he, as I say, calculated it all. And when he says in verse 6, my feast is not yet come, my feast is not yet prepared, it's not yet ready. Maybe he sensed that his own development needed to still go ahead, so that he would come to the point where he was the absolutely mature sacrifice for sin. And that his brothers say, if you do these things, verse 4, then show yourself to the world, because his brothers didn't believe in him. That's similar, really, to come down from the cross so that we may see and believe. It's similar to the temptation in the wilderness. Throw yourself off the temple, and then people will see and believe. And it says that the devil departed from him for a season, implying he returned, and, you know, he in the quotation marks. The idea being, I think, that this temptation kept on and on in his life. If only I could do something dramatic, they'd all believe. Well, he knew that faith is not based upon what you see. And again, you see how Jesus endured temptation that repeated, kept on and on, which again is a characteristic of our lives, that circumstances tend to repeat. As someone said to me the other day, oh, I had that difficulty with my first wife, and then I had it with my second wife, and then I had it with my third wife, and I've got it with my present wife. And I'm thinking, okay. So in other words, difficulty or temptation or circumstance repeat. That's how it is. You may live in one house and have a difficult neighbour whose dog keeps wrecking your fence. And then you go to the next house where you live, and it's the same problem, and the same problem. These are silly little examples. What I'm saying is that temptation tends to repeat. Circumstance repeats because there's a divine hand in all this. And although we can't attach meaning to event immediately, it's all under his control. Now, his brothers did not believe in him. He'd grown up with them for 30 years as their big brother. And they didn't believe in him. It's rather like when he stands up at age 30 in the synagogue in Nazareth where he had grown up and basically says, I'm Messiah. these prophecies in Isaiah about Messiah, this is me. And the people say, no, it can't be you. We know your brothers, and you're the son of Joseph. You're the carpenter. Now, Jesus never sinned at any point in his life, including in his life until age 30. He never committed a sin of omission. That is, he never omitted to do anything he should have done. He never committed any sin. So he would have been a wonderful person. He never sinned, never omitted to do anything that he should have done. And yet the people he grew up with didn't think he was anything special. They thought he was an ordinary bloke, that he's the carpenter, and we know his brothers and sisters. Why does he got this idea he's the son of God? And his brothers likewise. No, Jesus was our big brother. He was one of us. He's not a Messiah. And in those reflections, I find something beautiful about his character. That he was utterly spotless. The Son of God, holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and nobody ever noticed. That's beautiful. That is a real insight into his character. Whenever you and I act a bit more righteously than the people around us, let's say in the workplace or some social situation, people think, who do you think you are trying to be more righteous than the rest of us? You know, whereas there was something about him that was so human that he was able to be, as it were, well, he was perfect, not as it were perfect, he was perfect. Never sinning, always doing the right thing, never omitting, and I think that's beautiful, that he never omitted to do any righteousness. And people didn't notice that he was anything special. And when he says finally at age 30, I am your saviour, I'm Messiah, his brothers, who knew him better than anybody, said, no, you're not. We don't believe that. His townspeople didn't believe in him. He had to say, a prophet is obviously not without honour, apart from in his own country. And I just think that shows that he was not this hard-faced religious reformer type. That he was, by personality, engaging, gentle, absolutely human, and so righteous that nobody ever noticed. Now that is, I think, absolutely beautiful about his character. Verse 13, nobody spoke openly about him for fear of the Jews. And that's the same word in 26. He speaks openly. And they say nothing against it. He spoke openly. He spoke boldly. He didn't hide now that he's in his ministry anything. He was quite upfront. But other people did not respond by speaking openly because they feared the Jews. They feared public opinion. And you see this, of course, with Joseph of Arimathea. In chapter 19, we're going to read that he had kept quiet for fear of the Jews. But when Jesus died, he came out openly and said, give me the body. And he was, I think, inspired to do that by seeing the Lord Jesus die on the cross, thinking, okay, I will be open like he was open, up front and open and bold in my faith, as this Jesus was. And again, what's wonderful about that is that Joseph and Nicodemus apparently didn't understand there was going to be a resurrection. They didn't do what they did, coming out openly in support of Jesus after he died, because they thought, well, he's going to resurrect and come again in glory and we're going to be on a good thing then. They didn't believe that at that point. They did it purely because they were motivated by the sight of his death. And we are here to remember that same death. And it should motivate us likewise, and we have even the more motivation because he has risen from the dead and we know that he is coming back in glory. Although no one spoke openly about him, verse 31 says, of the crowd many believed him. Many believed in him. And they said, when the Messiah comes, will he do more signs than those that this man has done? Well, that's pretty generous. To say that many believed in him, and it's a theme in John's Gospel that John credits faith, or Jesus credits faith, to people who were pretty weak, really. I mean, they didn't speak openly about him for fear of the Jews. And yet it says that many of them believed in him. Although they said they'd call him this man. They don't perceive, I don't think, that he is Son of God. And they leave it as an open question. When Messiah comes, will he do more miracles than these that we've seen done? And it said that they believed in him. And we are worried, aren't we, as to whether we really believe as much as we should. Is my faith strong enough? Is my faith real? And of course it's imperfect. But when you see the generosity of spirit that there is here towards people whose understanding of Jesus was weak or faulty, and their actual faith was weak because they did not speak openly about him for fear of the Jews, and yet their faith is credited. Admittedly, it's weak. And this encourages us personally, in the first instance, that we may be weak, but we still believe. I found myself saying this to Jesus so many times, that I am so weak, but you know, I really do love you, and I do believe in you, but I'm sorry, my faith and my love is so weak. And I take comfort from all this, that this weak faith crowd, it's still counted to them. Now, that doesn't mean it's okay that don't worry about it, you just got to believe a little bit. No, it inspires us the other way, that if he's so acceptant and so positive, well, I want to give everything for him, actually. Not the minimum, but the maximum. And I think it is also some comfort as we look around in life and we see people and we can't stop ourselves as we're only human, thinking, does he really believe? Does she believe or not believe? Sometimes you think he does or she does, and then you think, maybe not. Look, Jesus is very open and eager for acceptance, to accept people's faith. That's a simple takeaway from this. Okay, so back in 15, the Jews marveled, saying, how is it that this man has such learning when he has never had an education? They've done a background check on him, and it seemed that he was from a poor background. That means he didn't go to school. And yet they were surprised that he could read. Well, he was an intellectual without compare as the Son of God. So I guess learning to read as a child was pretty easy for him. You know, he could have worked out the surface tension on a cup of water if he wanted to. He had that kind of mind because he was God's son. He had that side to him. But my point is that he came from a poor background. And therefore, you can see how we can never blame tough background or difficulty, whatever, as an excuse as to why we shouldn't believe or be committed. Because he went through all that. He says something I rather like in 17 and 18, which is not quite on the theme of the personality of Jesus, although maybe it does reflect something of it. He says, well, 16, my teaching isn't mine, but it's God's. If anyone wants to do God's will, he will know of this teaching, whether it is of God. He's saying the way that somebody comes to know that I'm telling the truth is not by intellectual process. It's not by going through in great intellectual detail looking up Hebrew and Greek words. He's saying that if someone truly loves God and truly wants to do God's will, he will intuitively know that what I'm saying is true. Earlier this week, I was in Italy and I was with some very poorly or pretty well uneducated folks from Africa who had managed to get to Italy. And I explained the gospel to them and baptized them. They were largely illiterate, and it would have been no point in saying, now look at this verse and look at that verse. I had to tell them things like, Jesus was our representative. He He was like us. He had our nature. He had all our feelings. He knows how you feel. And baptism is like dying with Jesus. And I could see the lights going on in their eyes. It all made intuitive sense. And these guys had been to other churches that had taught them something different. They saw intuitively, straight away, the logic and the sense and the truth in the gospel that I had presented to them. Not because they were literate people who could go away and analyze, but because it all adds up. If anyone will do his will, God's will, he shall know, Jesus says, that my teaching is from God. He's making an intuitive appeal. And then he says about teachers. And for illiterate people, your teacher is very important because you have no way to check who's, you know, whether he's telling the truth or not. He says in 18, he who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he that seeks the glory of him that sent him, the same is the true one. So he's saying that if your teacher is seeking his own glory, you know that what he's saying is not going to be true. But if the teacher seeks God's glory, and you can see that, the same is true. And so this really demonstrates, I think, that it's not all by, as I say, by intellectual process. That's what our community has, I suppose, gone a little bit wrong in sort of implying that if you study, look into this, compare this with that, and look up these words in a concordance, then you will come to this truth. That is okay for folks like ourselves who are literate and educated. But the vast majority of people in this world have not had that opportunity. Historically, I mean, in the past, generally. The gospel has not been a question of intellectual process to work it out. It's not as if God is playing hard to get and that the Bible is a riddle to be solved. And if you solve it, then you're good. No. It cannot be like that. That is not in passing. Jesus says in 19, why do you seek to kill me? And the crowd answered, you're crazy. Who's trying to kill you? Well, if I were Jesus, I would have answered and said, oh yes, I can give you 10 reasons why they're trying to kill me. But he doesn't. He's above that. He doesn't want to get involved in petty argument. No one's trying to kill you. And he doesn't say, oh yes they are, here's all the reasons. He says, I did one work and you all marvel. And the implication, I think, is and you all pretty well disbelieve it. You marvel in disbelief because of it. And what's the connection? He says, you want to kill me. No, we don't. No one wants to kill you. And he says, I did a miracle and you didn't believe it. In other words, he's saying, if you disbelieve me, then I'm afraid it will lead you to so much anger that you will want to kill me. But you just see his subtlety there, that he is not getting involved in black and white argument. You said that and it's wrong. I've got to correct you. He doesn't do that. And I think you see something of his subtlety later on in verse 52 when there's this argument that, Jesus is from Galilee. Search the scrolls and you'll see that no prophet is to rise from Galilee. Now Jesus could have muscled in there when he knew that that was being said and explained that, you know what, I wasn't born in Galilee, I was born in Judah, I was born in Bethlehem. And he could have also muscled in there and said, wrong, a prophet did come from Galilee and his name was Jonah. And Jonah from Galilee was a great type of me, 3 days, 3 nights in the whale. He doesn't do that. He doesn't make the obvious answer in the same way as he doesn't quote what we might consider to be the obvious scriptures. Isaiah 53, for example. He doesn't quote that. Now that is obviously about him. And it's not that he was just trying to be clever. I think it's because he knew that real persuasion doesn't come from this, you know, intellectual process, as I would call it. But it is a gift of his spirit. Likewise, They say, verse 27, we know from where this man is, but when the Christ comes, no one knows from where he is. They're saying, you can't be the Messiah, because when Messiah comes, nobody knows where he's from. Well, I think the obvious response to that would have been, excuse me, 30 years ago, Herod asked you the same question. Where is Messiah to come from? And you all put your hand up and said, Bethlehem. So in 30 years, they changed. They brought in this idea that Messiah, oh, nobody's going to know where Messiah comes from. 30 years ago, when they were asked the same question, where's Messiah coming from? Bethlehem, sir. Okay, I'll kill all the children in Bethlehem. Yeah, if I were Jesus, I would have said, sorry, guys, changed your story, haven't you? Changed your doctrine. Changed your theology. Because it's not convenient, because you had to cover up an inconvenient truth. The Messiah's from Bethlehem, and I'm from Bethlehem. But he doesn't. He says, from 28, he just cries out, you know me, and you know where I'm from. Again, it's a different kind of approach. Not trying to prove me right and you wrong. And it's far more powerful. When he says, you know me, it's like the parable when the husbandmen say, this is the heir, let's go and kill him. So, moving on. Yeah, verse 34. Where I am, you cannot come. We might expect him to say, in a different tense, where I am going, you cannot come. But he says, where I am, you cannot come. In other words, he's purposefully using the present tense. In Greek, unlike Hebrew, is very specific in its use of tenses. I think by the I am, where I am, you can't come, I think he's meaning that where I'm going to, that is fellowship with God, I'm already there. But unfortunately, you can't come there. But in John 17, he prays to God and says, I ask you that they may be with me where I am. Not where I will be, but where I am. He's saying, I want them to have the sort of relationship